Welcome to Declarations of War Podcast. This is episode 59. Thank you for tuning in. We are your hosts, Alexei Avkard, Ninja Turtle.
Hello.
And CSM representative, Ali Aras.
Hey, what's up?
Some shout-outs. I'd like to give a shout-out to Mildly Intoxicated for hosting us in their space and catch. Good hunting, bros, and it was great working with you again.
Hey, guys. Turtle here. I want to give a big shout-out to the Choboxer. Ran a sick fleet this weekend. So ran out about 10 bill worth in damage over the course of a few hours. And also a big shout out to Nelly Secunda for taking a few hours to kick that entire corp out of their alliance due to one AWOXer. So full of win, laps to be had. Thanks, bro.
And lastly, I want to give a shout out to all the Nora pilots who we hung out with on Sunday morning for, you know, fleeting up and hanging out again, even if that ended incredibly badly. But it was a lot of fun while it was fun.
Yeah, we had a wormhole out to Curse Alley, and I stayed the fuck out of it.
It was fun while it was fun.
So it goes in Eve.
Okay, let's get right into the big thing that everybody wants to talk about. The new expansion. It's been announced. It's looking good.
I'm very excited.
But you are. So let's get into brass tacks. We'll try to cover the stuff everybody knows, like, pretty quickly. And then we'll get into some analysis here. So it's called Rubicon. It's going to be coming out in mid-November. And they had the rollout on Twitch, and they went over what I presume to be either the stuff that they have done and can 100% confirm now, or the sort of headliner changes. Allie, would you happen to know which of those two it was?
Which specific feature was? I mean, it was a combination of both.
Okay. Well, then I would ask, are there going to be more what you would consider core parts of the expansion that were not touched on because they're still in flux?
I mean, there's going to be more stuff that's coming out. One of the things that they touched on is like, we're going to get around to this, but didn't touch on more thoroughly was like the interdictory balance, which I'm interested to see how that's going to go. But we didn't even get any hints as to what that's going to look like. And of course, there's a couple more things the CSM knows about. It's hard for me, from my perspective, to sort of say, all right, well, this is a core thing, because each particular thing is going to impact someone's gameplay in a different way. You know, the high set Care Bear is going to be really excited about, like, the auto tractoring structure, whereas as a null sec PvPer, I look at that and I kind of go, oh, okay.
Well, but certainly, say, like, for instance, I would say that being able to deploy new structures in space, headliner feature, a change to the turret skill requirement, while important, and we are going to go into it, probably not, like, the thing that I would run and tell someone who's never played Eve about. Like, oh my god, now you don't have to train this to get large turrets. It's great, right?
I mean, it is actually great for a newbie. That was one of the things that they put to the CSM, and I just, like, I've had so few opportunities to be the CSM that I campaigned to be, sort of like new player champion or whatever, but they suggested that in the summit, and I jumped on it, and I went, yes, because I had, like, my first big major post was a CVA forum post, and it was, like, an essay about why T2 large lasers were bad. So, it's certainly going to be meaningful to the person coming into Eve. But you're right, it's not the kind of thing that I would go up and I would say, hey, guess what my expansion did? It made it less shitty to be you.
So, I mean, we touched on the turret skill requirement, so let's go into it. This was not announced at the Twitch stream, it was sort of a follow-up. They're changing how turrets work skill-wise, and they're making it closer to the recent change that they put in for, say, battleships or capital ships, where you no longer have to train the small and medium turrets to 5. Or, you know, just... If you get the ability to train large turrets, which I think comes at, like, turret 3 or something like that, then you have to train the actual turret that you want to get Tech 2 turrets for up to 5, and then you can train the specialization. But that's it.
Yep, that's... That's the change. It brings them, you said more in line with like the battleship or the capital ships. For me, it's more in line with the way that they changed missiles. Or not the way that they changed missiles, but the way that missiles have always worked. If I want to train, you know, Tech 2 heavy assault missiles, I don't first have to train Tech 2 rockets. And so missiles have always worked that way. It's a lot easier to get into, you know, a perfect T2 missile ship than it is into a perfect T2 turret ship, because you don't have what's a couple of weeks of training time in order to get into a specific Tech 2 weapon type.
Yeah, I like when they do this, the tier aside like this, because it's good for the new player experience. You can't really argue about that. And it does really cut down on it, because you had to train like each first Tech 2 to like 4, so it was a long time to train for large Tech 2 guns. And so if you already got the skills, like, you can't really complain because you already have them, and if you don't have the skills, it's good. So I mean, it's cool that they do this shit.
Well, I could have done without training small artillery specialization to 4, you know, for all the yep. times that I use that. I, you know, my knee-jerk reaction was, oh, they're like, this is not really a great change. They're going to accelerate, you know, players coming in and just being able to fly whatever they want at the same skill level as the older players. But then I thought about it a little bit, and I think you have to look at this change in the context of the other balancing work they've been doing on weapons. Now, like, you can actually say that bigger is no longer absolutely better. I think they still have a bit of a ways to go with some of the short-range weapons, but, like, if you compare T2 long-range guns to T2 medium-range, or T2 large long-range to T2 medium long-range, like, they change stuff. Like, now they track way better, and they mm-hmm. do more damage to smaller targets, whereas large guns track quite poorly in almost all cases, and while they do great damage, you know, they're vulnerable to small targets. So you can train for a tornado with Tech 2 artillery, okay. But, you know, someone who's specialized in, say, a Tech 2 Hurricane or a Tech 2 Munin, they're doing a different role. So that kind of makes it okay for me. I think they need to tweak it a little bit on the short-range guns, because I don't think there's that same dichotomy between, say, large blasters and medium blasters. Like, I still feel large blasters pretty much track okay. I don't know that, like, dumping on their tracking is really the right way to go either, but, you know, I can see the direction that Fozzy and Ryze are going with weapon systems, and I think it just makes sense to have it be you can train for what you want to specialize in. You don't have to train everything that arbitrarily comes before it in some kind of size progression, because that progression is becoming increasingly irrelevant the more and more they balance.
Yeah, and even if it's not, you know, even if maybe before, you know, T2, like, I'm thinking about Alley, I have Tech 2 autocannons, medium autocannons, and I have those because I wanted to fly kiting ships like the Vagabond, like the Stabber, you know, I wanted to fly a really good Loki, and I, you know, I, as a result of that, have small autocannon specialization to 4. Even if, you know, you could fly a Wolf like you fly a Vagabond, even if it's a similar kind of, you know, oh, well, it's Minmatar kiting turret ship. You know, they're still gonna be flown in different fleets, and I think even if you look before Tyrosside, they're still gonna be flown in different fleets, and it was still a lot of training time that I spent on something that I never intended to specialize in. I intended to specialize into Galente assault frigates, and, you know, I've used my small blaster specialization for dozens of times. But the Minmatar one was just sort of a side effect of the skill training requirements. So I think even if you look at it historically, it wasn't before the balancing, I don't think there was a big justification for that either, other than just, well, we walked uphill both ways in the snow back in my day, so everyone else should too.
I will say that it probably depends who you fly with, too. I mean, there's going to be some groups of people where having to train medium artillery spec to 4 is, like, a prerequisite for their Munin fleets, and other entities that will never fly Munin, so it's kind of, you know, it's all whipped up in the meta. But I like what you said, Alex. You really did describe the tier side really well, is like making that training progression kind of irrelevant, and the whole concept of training progression is irrelevant. Tier side.
Yeah, the one thing people have been complaining about is they've been saying, well, now it's easier to train into Tech 2 weapons than it is to train into... Or it's easier to train into, like, a Tech 2 turret weapon than it is into a Tech 2 missile weapon. I just checked on Evemon to train my, like, Sino-Alt for a perfect rocket launcher with the skills as they are now would take her 34 days, and to train her into perfect both autocannons and... artillery would take her like 49 days. I think if I did light missiles here too, it would still come out to either even or a little bit less time on the rockets, because you can train one initial skill, the turret skill, in order to get both the short and long range weapons. But once you get into the T2 specialization, you have to train two different skills, as opposed to just being able to go straight, basically, you know, if I want to go into rockets, I don't have to spend any time training into, I don't have to spend any time training into light missiles, whereas I have to do that for the turret ones.
Alright, well, the, skill requirement changes are far from the only feature in Rubicon. I want to talk about the biggest deal second. We already touched on the deployable structure, so let's go into that. There's going to be new stuff you can anchor in space. Are we going to use the MP word? No, out of respect for the sanity of CCP employees, but it does sound like a lot of the things that people were looking for in terms of a mobile habitat in the middle of space that is not a player-owned starbase.
It's also cheaper than a player-owned starbase, and it's an individually owned thing instead of a corporate-owned thing. You know, for a player-owned starbase, that's a corporation asset instead of an individual one. This, you know, I've been calling it the space yurt, is that, you know, deployable structure where I can refit my stuff and store a little bit of loot or fittings or whatever. You know, a space yurt is something that I put up for me. It's not something that I have to have a role in a corporation in order to put into space somewhere.
So you're going to be able to store stuff in this, and it'll have essentially a ship maintenance array function where you can change your fitting. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of like a smaller yet hybrid version of the corporate hangar and the ship maintenance array.
Yep, and it's something that'll be... I'm really looking forward to it because I spend a reasonable amount of time wandering around in space by myself doing, you know, PvP or what have you. So being able to have something that I can just plonk down so that I can refit either, you know, refit between PvP and PvE so I can actually take advantage of all those exploration sites that are located deep in renter pockets in Nullsec, or, you know, be able to refit knowing, okay, well, a couple jumps away, there's this particular fleet that's waiting for us. And I've got a couple of newts in my cargo hold, and if I refit to those, I bet I can take out their rep. Or, you know, just being able to adapt while on my own or with a small gang far away from my home station is going to be game-changing for Nullsec roaming in particular.
I might even have some...
It's got some, like, really cool features.
In combat application, like, first thing I thought of was how carriers refit off one another, you know, when they're under attack. Now you wouldn't necessarily need to deploy two triage carriers to do that, or, you know, if you have an entirely subcap fleet, you could launch one of these and be able to swap your high slots, your hardeners, your jammers, for sure, depending on what's going on. I mean, depending on the anchoring time, but it doesn't sound like it's going to be overly burdensome to anchor these things.
Even if it does take a while to anchor, I can, if I'm going to be at all static, you know, camping someone's gate or someone's station or whatever, I can just anchor one of them and force the fight onto that structure.
Fuzzy mentioned some really cool features about it, too. Obviously, it doesn't require a pass, like you said. It's not going to solicit a Concord response in high sec when you attack it. He said something, I think, at least like a suspect timer, which would be cool. It's also got a reinforced timer, too, which does actually give it some viability in combat. You can't just get a drive-by, and because I'm assuming it's going to be probable, too, so you got to have some layer of defense there with that, and it seems like a cool module.
And he also mentioned, or well, he hinted at the during or just after the reinforcement timer, you can just pick it up. You don't have to repair it or something.
Well, I think honestly, for me, the biggest thing that he said was kind of between the lines, and he made a point of saying that this was running on a new POS code, and it, or well, not a new POS code. It was running on a new code that wasn't going to have legacy issues with the old POS code, because things like the material siphon, you know, they have to be anchored outside of a POS.
And he mentioned that they would be scale upable.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look long term, like in a couple of years, I think that bodes actually really well for getting some well needed changes.
Mm-hmm. The siphon, I'm a little underwhelmed by, actually. So the siphon's going to be something you can stick outside of somebody's moon mining POS, and it will, or I guess production POS as well, and it will steal stuff that that POS is creating. I don't see a way that this is going to happen, because the way it sounds like it's going to be an overtime thing. You would have to be really, really, really absent from your entire POS network to not notice that someone has anchored this outside your structure.
I mean, I don't know
and
if you've seen...
It was
like...
going to be as easy as turning one POS gun on it. That's all you have to do. So one alt can log in and take care of it.
I mean, if you think about, like, PL's POS empire or whatever, though, you've got these empires of high-value POSs stretching all over the galaxy, and it's a way to at least affect those without being able to necessarily contest the reinforce.
I bet you could totally,
cool.
You could totally find a PL tower somewhere that's mining an R64 with no guns and just drop it on there. If it doesn't like bring up a notification or something, that would be perfect. Because you could,
notice it eventually when they come to pick up their material or fuel it or random dude.
You
goes
can't
by
look at it.
Hey,
maybe
PL.
You can't look at it on a week by week basis. Maybe it's a day to day basis and just a coordinated thing of a couple alts everywhere that can run around and do that, Gulky Hauler or something.
It really depends on how much it's going to take and over what time frame. If it steals stuff over the course of a few hours, then yeah, absolutely. If it's going to take a week for you to see significant returns, then I don't think you're going to be getting those modules back. They're either... Because remember, the owner of the POS can steal the stuff back. So you could wind up not getting anything and them losing nothing and them just laughing while they blow up your stuff.
Yeah, I definitely think... I think if there's anything I'm, like, worried about there, it's how it's going to end up balanced in terms of what the cost is. You know, obviously, POSs are extremely valuable over the long scale, but if I'm roaming and I find a PL tower, it's not like this will cause me to be able to... It's not like this will cause me to be able to take all their stuff. And you know, maybe that's fine. Maybe I should have to invest a little bit more time. You know, maybe I should have to log my Viator alt next to it in order to actually get a lot of money from it. But, I think it'll be interesting disruption-wise, and I think that it'll certainly hurt people whose POSs are very, you know, spread out or lightly managed. I don't think it's going to be as... I don't think it's going to be as huge as Space Yurts.
We've also got the tractoring thing, which...
This is a huge PvE quality of life. improvement.
And a big fuck you to the Noctis.
I guarantee you.
Now no longer has any point.
I guarantee you people there's more than one Care Bear out there that cares.
I would have never trained an Noctis alt if I had this. People keep telling me, oh, well, the Noctis salvage is faster. Oh, well, what do you do when you have T2 salvage or sleeper salvage? I'm like, I don't give a fuck. I just need to salvage, you know, I just need to salvage my hub, and I could just warp in my destroyer, which costs less than 10 million and has incredibly quick agility.
But can you fit that thing inside of a destroyer? Like, I bet you the Noctis is still going to be really, like, viable in this scenario, because it's what go out and drops there, or drops the thing. So instead of having to have, like, four tractors and four salvagers, you can just go, like, straight salvagers now. And it's going to probably make the process quicker. That's what I'm betting. It depends on how big that module is.
I mean, I'm figuring I can carry that module in my ratting ship. I drop it in the, you know, hub that I'm running, and it just tractors and sort of puts everything in a nice little pile while I'm killing all the NPCs. I warp my alt in her destroyer in, I salvage the entire thing, which is now just in this pile, because it's been slowly tractoring stuff as I kill it. And, you know, having gone through all that, I don't see the utility of a Noctis over something that's going to be cheap, and it's going to get away a lot easier if someone decides to come in and gank it.
Well, but then again, the Noctis hasn't been through the rebalancing process, so maybe it gets a new look at its role soon.
Yeah, so you say ratting ship, but like ratting battleship or a ratting Ishtar? Because I'm betting that thing won't fit into an Ishtar. I bet that's going to be like a battleship module. Not, you know what I mean. It's only going to be fitting in some of the bigger ships, so... You know, I could see Noctis coming in, dropping that at the end and stuff, because you don't want to leave it out, because it's going to get ganked. Like, that's the whole thing. And I'm betting you'll spit out a can.
Right.
So, like, you do it at the end and just let it tractor everything up. But, I don't know.
I don't know.
It might have a nice PvP side effect of causing people to linger in their sights a little bit longer, not aligned. Mostly applicable to 0-0. Because... it's a really convenient way of getting salvage, which, I mean, most people just run for pure ISK out there. But now that this is a really convenient way for them to get extra money out of the sites, whereas previously it was a huge pain in the ass unless you did have a second account, they may opt for this option where they have their battleship, they run the site, afterward they plop it down, and they actually do take the time to salvage it as it comes in, or they're going to need to be close to the structure to do it. Which means they're not going to be able to align to their station. So that can be a very interesting side effect.
It'll certainly be... What I'm really interested in seeing is how, like, this will combo with the interceptor change, which if I can just sort of, like... interceptors and warp speed. Because it's going to be... One of the other things that got announced is they're changing warp speed, so now you accelerate into warp faster if you warp faster. So things like interceptors can get on a ratting battleship in 10 seconds from coming into the gate.
Yeah, we still
I think
got,
this is going to be the thing that
we
changes
still got
the game.
Sino jammers to talk about too, and we glanced over probably one of the biggest PvP announcements was.
All right, well, we'll do the Sino jammers real quick.
One-time use Sino Jammer, short range USAN, only like 70 to 100 kilometers. Still won't stop a covert Sino though, so Blobsters, don't worry. I was a little underwhelmed with this one myself, but I don't know. I can see its applications, and it's some protection is better than none.
I can see putting that on gates the way you put bubbles on gates. Just like put it on a gate that's in your system so that if you're fighting a gang that's coming in, they can't just, you know, drop whatever they have sitting on their Titan on you. And you can actually take the fight you're looking at.
Yeah,
but
say
it was going to be one shot, which means presumably there's going to be a duration on these things, so you can't anchor it like a bubble, for instance, and have it be up all day.
Yeah, and to be honest, if you put it... Here's why I was a little bit underwhelmed, because I thought of a scenario like that. Maybe something coming through a gate. If you anchor that thing on a gate, realistically, they're just going to drop you like 40 to 60 kilometers away.
That's 40 to 60 kilometers away. I mean, there's a lot you can't do from that range. And I'm thinking mainly of tackle things without Proteuses, especially with the new link changes. So it'll give you some reaction time, which is good.
And if you see a ship that's, you know, burning off into the distance, you know, burning 40, 60, whatever kilometers away, that can be assigned to disengage before the actual Sino goes up.
I don't know. I don't see it really changing capital fleets that are moving, like, with subcap fleets when subcap fleets are the reason they're deployed, rather than just, like, a straight hot drop, which is kind of what you were talking about, because if you got subcaps coming through the gate, you know, it doesn't really matter if they're, like, 40k off. Just meet in the middle. So, I don't know. I don't see a ton of applications with it, but I could be wrong.
I think we're going to see it become commonplace in the PvP meta that, you know, one side or the other is going to try to deploy this, and the other side will either try to get their caps in before it's done, or destroy it and then do the caps, or pull a fight off for caps, or, you know, there's going to be, I think, a lot of dancing around these deployable Sino Jammer things. And it'll be interesting. I think it'll be one of those things where the groups that have Titans are going to curse it, and everyone that doesn't have Titans and doesn't rely on those to roam around is going to, you know, it's going to feel like it levels the playing field. I think it's probably a long overdue balance thing, although I'm sure it's going to need to be tweaked once it goes live. No matter what they do to it, I doubt they're going to get it just right on launch. So I imagine they're going to be revisiting it.
Someone's going to find some way to exploit it, or some way to deploy it in a way that makes their, you know, capital up or what have you completely safe. It does kind of raise interesting things for, like, if you think about baiting with carriers, because, you know, you think, oh, well, I'm going to put a carrier on the POS and I'm going to, or undock a carrier from the station and just leave it as bait. In order to bait, say, a super capital hot drop, you can now deploy one of these on your legitimate POS repping operation to prevent people from dropping your POS rep operation with super caps. And so it comes into sort of this, like, well, if you don't deploy one of these, then it's obviously bait. And if you do deploy one of these, then, you know, you get the safety. So I don't know how that's going to change that particular little cat and mouse game. But I leave that to people who fly super capital ships and decide to drop on carriers.
I think it'll depend how quick and how many you can get them out. I mean, if you can drop them like Dictor bubbles, yeah, it's going to be like completely different than if they take, like, I don't know, what, 8 minutes it takes to tech one large bubble to anchor or something like that. You know, if you're not going to be able to just spin them out on demand.
Even if it takes like 8 minutes, you'd be, and if you have a POS to rep, you would be stupid not to deploy one of these on your POS.
Here's the thing, you can be really meta about it. Deploy one on your carrier, wait till it expires, and hope that you get ganked because you haven't put another one out, and then you jump your super cap fleet on top of whatever they dropped on you.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, it's just one of these whole, you know, well, I know that you know that I have this out, so...
Yeah, it's an extra layer of the back and forth with Eve, which isn't necessarily bad. I think even that is not as big of a change as this warp mechanic.
I'm incredibly excited about that.
Yeah, I think this changes everything. It's probably going to be the biggest change since the micro warp drive and warp scrambler changes back in the day.
I obviously was not around for that, but for people who haven't, you know, heard, basically your ship now accelerates. If your ship warps faster, your ship accelerates into warp faster. The sort of truism of Eve has been that if you have someone at like a perch point over a gate, they will warp down to the gate at the same, like an interceptor will warp down to the gate at the same speed as a battleship. This is no longer true.
Or I'm even thinking longer distances, like it's almost commonplace to align your fleet and warp it together, because who the F cares? Everyone's more or less going at the same speed, so you might as well have everyone land the same. But now you're going to have much more incentive to split your fleet up by ship size, because that little difference in speed between a battleship and a cruiser is going to be a huge difference in terms of actually landing someplace. It'll open up new opportunities for those cruisers to get the jump on battleship fleets. No longer will it be like, you see a battle cruiser get one jump ahead of you and you're in your vagabond, you're like, well, he'll probably get to that gate, jump through, and then warp to the station before I can really react. But now, you know, if he just warps off your gate when you land and you react quick enough, you can turn around and warp to the gate that he's headed to. You will probably get there ahead of him, instead of this time where it's a coin flip if you're lucky. I mean, I've been outrun by freaking hurricanes in an interceptor before, like yep. two or three jumps, and then that last jump, you figure, oh, I'm gonna get them. He's like already visible on the other side of the gate, but you're just entering cloak, you lock it, before you can activate your point, he warps off. But no more. You're actually going to be able to intercept things. You're going to be able to overtake slow ships with fast ships in a much more immediate fashion. I'm pretty pumped. As a guy that really, really likes cruiser-sized ship doctrines and who flies interceptors constantly, I'm elated. Like, it makes those fleets a lot more competitive compared to battleships. You can actually kite around those battleship fleets in a more meaningful way. I mean, you can still do it now, and it is done now, but it's one of those things where, like, they're still sort of keeping pace with you.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it really comes down to your line time more than anything else. That's the lead that you have. Once you get into warp, it's pretty much exactly the same, because even if you theoretically warp faster than they do, most of your time spent in warp, unless you're in a system that's like 50, 60, 70, 80 AU large, is spent accelerating to your maximum speed and decelerating back to normal speed. And that process, up till Rubicon, has been the same whether you're in a frigate or a battleship. So effectively, you were going the same speed. You only got a speed advantage on the time it took you to actually go into warp. So if you put a 1600mm plate on a sacrilege, and your opponent's are smart and they're using the micro warp drive trick for battleships, where you align somewhere, activate your micro warp drive, and then kill your micro warp drive to warp in 10 seconds, you are almost going the same speed. And that sucked. But now it's completely different.
And, you know, this is going to mean that if you formed up your kitchen sink gang and you've got an interceptor or whatever and you're chasing my small little battlecruiser gang out of your pocket, sure, you're going to be able to catch a battlecruiser or two on the way out. But, I mean, the solution to that is to just bring destroyers or bring, you know, instead of roaming in battlecruisers, try roaming in assault frigates.
This can be really great for those roaming fleets, too, because yeah. not only can they cover more ground more quickly, but if they do see a kitchen sink fleet, like you're saying, it'll be easier to pick those people apart and spread them out, because if they do send their frigates and destroyers ahead to chase you, the larger ships that are more of a threat to you are going to take more time to catch up. It gives you a larger window to actually fight the parts of the fleet that you can maybe take successfully, and then escape.
Yeah, nobody's gonna, you know, I doubt fleet warp obviously is gonna keep fleet warping people at the same speed, but no one's, you know, I don't think any kitchen sink Care Bear defense fleets have ever used the fleet warp button in my memory.
And sometimes you don't even want to use the fleet button. Maybe you really do yeah. want your interceptors, to go chase after that vagabond because you want to kill him. Or you think that you can, but then you find out that vagabond's actually like a Prometheus Exenthal alt, and he pulls your interceptors two jumps away and kills them all. Or hell, even breaks them up in the system by going to one planet, then going to another planet. I mean, you can already currently do this, but instead of buying you a window of like 10 or 15 seconds, maybe it buys you a window of 30 to 40 seconds where you can fight without being interrupted.
Sure. I'm excited. Not to mention, I, you know, you can use this to gank people who are running anomalies a lot more easily. So if your roaming objective is to just, you know, jump on everyone's Care Bears, they announced that interceptors are likely to be receiving interdiction nullification. So those systems with 100 km of bubbles around the ingate, you can jump in, warp to the nearest hub or haven or whatever, land on something juicy, and get it tackled for the rest of your fleet to get there.
That's going to make shotgunning really fun, too. You can get, like, if you can get a fleet of maybe 10 interceptors that are really good at the same time, jump them all in, and they can pretty much blink to all the valuable parts of your system at once. Mm-hmm. That's going to be brilliant.
And, you know, the balance part to that is they're interceptors. If an interceptor ever stops moving, it's tissue paper that just explodes.
Yep, and they have a lot of counterplay. I mean, they can be hunted by assault frigates, they can be hunted by certain Tech 1 frigates, they can be hunted by Tech 2, or excuse me, not Tech, what am I thinking of? They can be hunted by interdictors, they can be hunted by destroyers, they can be hunted by rapid light missile launcher cruisers, hunted by rapiers, hunted by certain ships with Tech 2 guns, like, I think Scorch, under certain circumstances, is pretty good against them, depending on their angle of approach. And there's a lot of counterplay to... They can be neutered out as well. And there's a lot of counterplay to interceptors. So I think giving them the interdiction nullification is only going to be game-breaking in that they will never be catchable by a gate camp again. Like, you'd have to be brain-dead to die.
Right.
But once they actually tackle something and stop running away and actually decide to fight or do something, there's going to be a lot of things that players can do to kill them, so I don't think it's going to be terribly broken.
Yeah, and with that gate camp, too, it's not like they cloak. It's not like, you know, the cloaky Loki just hope that you're where he spawned kind of gate camp running technique.
Well, they're going to be instantly warping, so it might as well be. In fact, it's going to be harder to catch the interceptors than it is to catch the interdiction nullified Tech 3s.
Why is that? Because they just warp?
Because even a nullification Tech 3, especially the armor ones, you get a window of, I think it's between 4 to 6 seconds-ish, maybe a little bit more in the case of the Proteus and the Legion, to fly, say, another interceptor out with drones to try to decloak them, or you can spread out over the area and, like, orbit the entire gate at 12 kilometers and hope someone's close enough to decloak them. But with the interceptor, they don't have to cloak. They just right-click and warp, and they will warp away before even the most heavily sensor-boosted ship is able to stop them.
Good. Fuck and those heavily sensor-boosted ships.
Now, you can smart-bomb them on the other end of the gate when they land, because it's only going to take one large to kill them. So, I mean, there's that aspect of it, too. But it's a really interesting dynamic that I'm pretty excited about. I'm an interceptor pilot. I love my Malediction and my Ares. And I'm pretty pumped. I hope that this isn't the end of the rebalance. He also hinted that he's tweaking it, or CCP Fozzie is going to tweak the hit points of a few of them, some up, some down. Also looks at certain the lock range, and maybe even some of the weapon systems, like the Malediction's DPS is absolutely anemic, despite being a rocket launcher ship. So, there's definitely things to be done with these ships to make them a little more viable within the class itself. Like, some are really strong, some are not quite that strong, and need a little loving, or at least need to be exceptional in some way. And I'm hoping he takes that into consideration as well.
Let's talk about some of the loving. So we got interceptors, light interdictors, electronic attack frigates, and marauders are all
slated. He didn't really go into the interdictor thing, although he did say one thing about electronic attack frigates that I like is that they're getting a big range buff to their electronic
huge warfare. Range buff, like recon-like range. Like, it's gonna be a completely different ballgame for those electronic attack frigates if a Sentinel can nuke to 35k.
I'm super excited about that because they had a short range and they had a light tank, so there's basically nothing they can...
they were terrible.
Yeah, there's nothing, you know, like, great, alright, I can bring a Hyena. Well, can't web out that far, and, you know, given the range at which the Hyena can web, it's just gonna get blown off the field. Why would I bother spending that money?
I flew Kitsune once.
The Kitsune was the only one that was really viable, and that's because it was the only one that could do anything
jammed,
about 50
yeah.
kilometers.
I flew a Kitsune once. It died in a fucking fire in like 3 seconds. I never touched it again. So they're just so paper thin.
Yep. I really hope he takes a look at the tank and also the lock range. I mean, right now they have a lower lock range than the Tech 1 electronic frigates. I'm so if they're getting more range for the electronic warfare, I hope to God they get extended lock range too.
I'm hoping the interdictors are going to get a little bit of extended lock range as well. Right now it's basically mandatory on a fleet interdictor fit that you put a sensor booster on it, just because you can travel at such a speed that you can't start locking in time to point someone once you get in point range.
Do they really need to do that, though? I mean, I figure the interdictor is a bubble dropper machine.
Interceptor.
With tackle and secondary. Oh, the interceptor.
Interceptors,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, 100% agree there. You should not need to rig your interceptor to have it lock out to its maximum point range.
Yep.
Which you currently do. And especially with the new warp changes, I would love to, like, not fit the lock range rig and do be able to fit the warp speed increase rig, which is now going to be quite in demand, I think.
I seem to recall they were all bought out from JITA and relisted within moments of the announcement.
Well, I think the bigger point, like, because stuff like the light interdictors in EAF, none of that was really talked about that much, because it's all really in the process of being worked out. And one of the big points they kept making was the feedback threads on the Evo forums. They will be going up, or they are up already, so definitely hit those up and put your feedback in and talk about them. Let them know what you think. Please write something sensible and concise and not completely fucking retarded.
What would you guys like to see as the interdictor change? Like, do they need a relook? I think maybe a little durability. Like, I would say if I could do anything to the interdictors, I would specialize them more into the bubble dropping role and less in the Tech 1 destroyer role of anti-frigate combat. So maybe reduce the combat capability, but increase the fitting so they could do more stuff with bubbles and tank.
I would be happy to see there's the whole, you know, joke about, like, well, there's the fast interdictor, and there's the tanky interdictor, and there's the high DPS interdictor, and then there's the Kaldari, Galente, and Amar interdictors. I would just like to see that rectified.
In true Soundwave fashion, I would just make the other three interdictors all like the Saber, and then everybody would be happy. The price would go down, and yeah, everybody could just fly a Saber.
As far as balance points, I think probably the ideal place is really the Heretic. I've always felt the Heretic, it's like the next, it's not as expensive as the Saber, but you can still, like, double bubble it, or bubble and combat fit it, you can shield it, you could armor it if you were crazy and wanted it to die constantly. It's like, it's a good ship. It's not amazing, but I think it'd be an excellent baseline for the class. Generally speaking, though, I would like to see them focused on that bubble dropping role more, because they're the only ship that can do it. Plenty of other things can tackle and can fight frigates and all that stuff. And they're pretty vulnerable while they're doing it, so any changes that could be done to make them a little more survivable or effective at it would be appreciated, I would think.
Marauders are probably going to get a little
bit... I feel
bit,
like we already talked about Marauders.
A little bit more PvE.
Didn't we talk about Marauders?
I don't think we did.
Their thread's been up since around the time of the summit.
Did we talk about them having a reduced micro-jump drive timer?
Yeah, I feel like we did.
And the Bastion thingy?
Yeah,
okay, moving on. Oh, rapid heavy missile launchers.
Yes.
These will be
interesting.
If they follow the same logic, like, if you look at light missile launchers and rapid light missile launchers, the rapid ones, they do more damage. They have a lower base firing time. So if you kind of extend that upward, like, you could look at these things doing a lot of damage off a battleship, especially if they throw some bonuses like to ships like the Typhoon or the Raven missile platforms.
I think the interesting thing is how it's going to stack up to the newly buffed cruise missiles, because I feel like they're almost already doing sort of this. You know?
Yeah, but not to smaller ships. Not to, a Tengu that's going to try and Sig tank you.
Yeah, that's true.
What I'm interested in is what it's going to mean for support ships in large fleets. Are you going to have a situation where you can run your support ships not as, people in cruisers or lighter stuff, but as people in battleships with full-on battleship tank that are hitting cruisers with cruiser weapons?
It's really going to depend on the details, I think, here. The DPS, the fitting. I mean, what are you going to have to... I mean, you're not going to have to give anything up because presumably they would fit easier than crews. So what could you do with the space that it gives you in your ship? What other utility is that affording you if you take that cut in presumably range and damage? If you can fit, full heavy newts and, amazing tank and all this other stuff, I think that would be cool. But a lot of the missile ships... they really don't have a lot they can do with that spare space.
Yeah,
and there's only a large shield extender. There's not the equivalent of a 1600 millimeter plate. It's not you can go smaller guns, bigger tank. Especially battleships, your tank is pretty much going to be what it is, and you're mostly using hardeners for it anyway.
It'll certainly be interesting to see where they go in terms of large fleet meta. Or even mm-hmm. just roaming meta. Certainly you can use them to counter someone trying to sig tank you in Tengus.
Oh, someone's trying to sig tank me. Launch my space yurt and swap out my torpedoes for these guys. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Maybe you'd be flying a new Sisters of Eve ship with a covert ops cloak, lolling in local.
This look pretty cool, actually.
Interesting combo.
I'll check one out.
Yeah, armor drone kind of thing, a Margalente faction.
Yeah, they look very pretty. It'll be nice to have, combat capable exploration ship will be nice, especially with the space yurt, just because then I can go and even if I'm just PvEing, I can go and I can refit between I'm doing a hacking site and I'm gonna do a 8 of 10 plex.
And they look fantastic, these new ships. Got a long, sleek design with then some kind of circle around them, which is something that's pretty standard. Not standard, but it's very iconic sci-fi wise to have some kind of circular engine or docking thing around a long tubular ship. And it just looks amazing.
Yeah, it looks like the ring ship from Battlestar Galactica.
Yes.
I was just rewatching that last night.
So yeah, depends on the price, but I could see myself flying one maybe, trying out some exploration content in it.
Yeah. Certainly good for your long nullsec roams.
The only thing I'd be wondering is whether or not it's going to have any hacking or archaeology type bonuses, because my understanding with the hacking sites is they are extremely difficult unless you have a bonus ship.
Yep, I can confirm that.
That'll be interesting to see if they add those utility bonuses as well as a combat bonus. One can hope.
Mm-hmm.
You've news.
Yeah, so that's about it for Rubicon so far, but we will definitely be coming back to this as more details are released, and we'll go into each of these changes as they get dev blogs. Moving on to Eve news, Red Frog, probably the most famous freighter company in Eve, in fact, maybe the only famous freighter company in Eve, had its first major theft. Their insurance company, which provides protection for their pilots if they get ganked or lose their cargo or whatever, called White Frog, got jacked to the tune of $45 billion.
It's not really so much just a $45 billion esque theft. It's it happened to Red Frog. They've never been ripped off before, and always seemed like they were really super secure, and they probably are. But
to be clear,
in every establishment, it's probably only one person it takes.
Customer assets were touched. To be clear. So it wasn't
that's what we're
stuff
saying.
Got stolen from people that were using the service. Red Frog service still secure, fine, I would use it myself.
Indicative of their completely structure.
Different. Right.
Yeah, I mean, from the write-up, it sounds like someone just decided, well, you know, I'm bored with this. Screw it, let's do something else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame. Like, but it's one of those things you always have to worry about when you have more than, like, 20, 25 billion in a wallet that someone has access to. It starts to look pretty tempting.
Yeah, what level of money is it worth screwing over whatever relationship you have with that organization? And it sounds like this was the amount.
Yep. Apparently it was a long-time guy, too. That's always rough. So, take this time to thank Turtle for not jacking my entire corp wallet when he left.
Yeah.
Well, $2 billion.
It was a whopping... Oh, was it that high?
Probably not.
I sold an altar on then, so I was a little distracted. I wasn't,
Didn't have your head in the game.
Yeah, I wish didn't make good on my promise.
Well, Goonstorm deployed to Curse. On top of everyone else deploying to Curse. And around the same time, the executor of Test Alliance quit, which...
He didn't quit, per se.
At least he was there for more than a month.
He stepped down, because he's still going to be in... Buddha's still going to be in, like, a corp CEO role. He's just not going to be, like, directing the Alliance anymore.
But still, that's, like, the fourth leadership change they've had in as many months. Although I will say, the other ones were, like, a week, 2 weeks in the job before they stepped down.
And Buddha was on... Buddha was the Alliance exec through the Fountain War, so he was...
Yeah.
It was more than a month for him. They've certainly been, you know, shedding other leadership left, right, and center.
I do not lump him with any of the previous Test Alliance leaders at all.
No, I'm not saying it like that, but I just mean, like, organizationally, it's kind of hard to have so much leadership change so rapidly. I think you did a relatively good job trying to keep them together during the Fountain War under some pretty impossible circumstances.
Yeah, well...
Like, there was no good outcome for Tess there, really, but that they stayed as together as they did for as long as they did, I think, is pretty much a good indication, especially considering the state of which the leadership was left when he got in. They had already had, like, 3 execs in 3 weeks.
Yep.
Fortunately for Tess, they seem to be bleeding members, and they've lost quite a few over the past month.
Believe they lost more corps too.
Yeah. They lost Southern Comfort to AAA. That was 200 members right there. They lost somebody to Insidious Empire, 200 members there. Some Alliance I've never heard of just picked up 2 of their corps, to the tune of over 220 members. Wow. They lost a 238 member corp to Nulli Secunda. Sure that hurt. But, you know, it's still Test. They still have over 6,000 members. So they're not, like, super in trouble. But if you look at that graph, like the dot line graph, that's pretty sick looking fail cascade in progress unless they start to stabilize.
It's a good slope. Slopes for the slope throne, etc.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Goonswarm deploying on top of them has not helped. So this would be... I don't know, I think we're just waiting on, like, Darkness of Despair and AAA to move to Curse.
And they live, like, reasonably... There. They live in Ketch, which is right... I mean, they're moving into Ketch, which is right next to Curse, so...
Sort of counts. Is there anyone that hasn't yet moved to Curse?
I don't know. Solar. Solar Fleet hasn't moved to Curse.
Alright, well, you heard it, Solar. Get on that. But yeah, I mean, this is a pretty jaded move by Goonswarm, but you know what? Probably the right one. Deploying literally in Test staging system to just crush their morale that much further. I think they really don't want to have the risk of Test, you know, being given a couch somewhere and being able to recover and then allying with, say, N3 or Solar or one of these other power blocks that's sort of jockeying for the next best behind CFC award.
Yeah, that is pretty fucked up. I will say that.
Cold-blooded.
Finish him!
Unity! But hey, man. That's what Goon does. They don't pull any punches. When they do something, they do it all the way till you're dead. But we had a poll about, you know, how would you feel, listener, if your corporate alliance decided to move to Curse? Yay or nay? 76% of our audience would be like, oh man, fuck that, if their alliance decided to move to Curse. So, that's interesting data, considering how many alliances are currently doing it.
One wonders how their membership is doing.
Yeah. I mean, Test membership obviously isn't liking it all that much.
Test membership is also, you know, getting shat on a lot, so...
Yeah. Personally, I would be nay. I mean, I've been to Curse, we've done some contracts there. It's just at an awkward spot in the galaxy for me. I mean, unless... I don't know, maybe I would try a different system if I did have to move there, but... I don't know. It seems like a place where you need to be big in order to be relevant. Whereas a lot of NPC 00, like Syndicate, is not that way. So I would rather be in Syndicate.
What's weird is it varies. Like, it... Right now, everyone and their grandmother is deployed. In a month, they will all undeploy, and then it will be back to being, you know, sort of small-town piracy. And it's just that right now it's immediately incredibly crowded.
What about you, Turtle?
No, I voted no. We didn't move to Curse. The only other news story of note is, I don't know, I think it's an interesting story, because if you remember about a year ago, the whole Dot Bros thing, it could have been a thing, right? It kind of was a thing. Until Vince Draken took out, like, what, 800 bill from the wallet and kicked Wicked Princess, that whole debacle. Well, they purged almost all of her alts, except for one that still had tower roles, and so Black Legion, who ironically was a Dot Bros member, ended up killing
it. Ironically, they were of the two Dot Bros, it was NC Dot and Black Legion. Like, that was the bros.
No, it's ironic that they then killed an Erebus for wanting to NC Dot.
Using that Wicked Prince assault.
Exactly. Thank you. You gotta let me finish the story. But that was the end of the story. Yeah, so they just burned an alt at the perfect time, and about an hour before, I think they killed a PL Aeon. So, in the course of a couple hours, they were riding pretty high that day, but... Stuff like that, it comes back to bite ya.
Certainly the last and latest word. It will be interesting to see if... I mean, it probably won't, but it'd be interesting to see if this sort of reignites that feud. Because it was a really interesting... I mean, the whole thing was sort of overshadowed by the CFC's expansion. Because Dot Bros were pretty much the only thing capable of holding them back at the time. And now that that's less of an issue, because it looks like Goonstorm's going to hit the pause button, at least for a little while. Do we see Black Legion and NC Dot openly fighting each other more often now, or is this a one-off thing?
That's a good question. Black Legion and Pandemic Legion are currently involved in a slap fight. They both deployed to Sendaya, right next to Doril, so it's effectively deployed to Curse. But that deployment into the same station was not an accident. It was, you know, a chance to train, shoot at each other's capital ships.
Well, it's all like the multi-regional level for him. Like, yeah, they deployed next to Curse, but they have access to a lot of regions in that area then for capital deployments, and That's a lot of what they do, is like dropping dreads on shit and killing it really quickly. And Elo's got the network for that in terms of contacts and everything. So, like, I know they're helping out Solar at the moment, but Solar's kind of whelping it too.
Yeah, the PLBL feud, to be honest, I'm surprised at how long it took to develop. You would think it was one of those natural things that was eventually going to happen. And it is happening now, but man, I figured it would have happened like a year or two ago.
See, and people put a lot of, read into a lot of that stuff. Like, when you read a headline, it's like, oh, Black Legion kills a PL, whatever, this and this. It's like, I don't know. That's just what it is at that level. Like, it's about killing capitals and dropping capitals to kill capitals and capital escalation. Like, that's just, that's like between you and me saying, oh, we did this and that and whatever with a subcap fleet. Like, it's just the level of their game, and like, people try and read a lot into it. I think there definitely is a kind of tension growing between the two, because it kind of seems to be that like Black Legion is doing the type of things with the type of efficiency and speed and like sheer fucking velociraptorness that PL had like a few years ago. So I feel like there's definitely that kind of like tension there between them for that. But I mean,
I think a lot of people view Black Legion now as what Pandemic Legion was before they hooked up with Tests for the Honey Badger thing.
Yeah, that's kind of the analogy I make.
Fighting the perception that they sort of jumped the shark. I don't really think that that's true, because they still have like the largest super capital fleet.
But that like is what creates that tension, right? Like, everybody has these perceived ideas of what's going on in the meta, and they can't really change it, and they just kind of look the way they look.
Well, there's also, I mean, there's PL losing their Revenant to Black Legion, which Black Legion was really excited about. There's
We'll never PL. Live that down.
No, they'll never live that down. There's PL losing a number of things to Black Legion. I've seen a number of cases where, you know, Black Legion dunks on PL or something, and PL does not escalate. And that, I don't, you know,
I think it's the case there's less opportunity. I mean, PL's the larger alliance. There's more, I think there's more opportunity for a group that's more, I don't know if that's exactly right to say, but I will. Like, more of an upstart group in comparison. Like, Black Legion was smaller. A lot of their success has come more recently over the past year or two. And they're really hitting this level. I think they're able to take more shots at Pandemic Legion than Pandemic Legion is able to answer back, just because of availability. I mean, they don't have a Revenant for PL to go kill in response, you know what I mean?
Right.
There's not exactly that much equivalency, and if Pandemic Legion does decide to take time away from whatever else they're doing to, like, attack Black Legion's towers or something, A, it means they're not going to be able to do something else, and B, would it even affect Black Legion all that much? I mean, I don't think they hold too much focus on the moons or space that they held. They always live in NPC space, so PL can't completely evict them or anything like that. It's just one of those things that they're sort of in a difficult area of like what to do as a response. And if they do focus on that, then they can't be doing other stuff. I think that it's just an inevitable thing. At a much, much smaller level, Noir has run into this too, where like, started out and no one had heard of us, then we got really good and people had heard of us. And then we did really, really good, and people were like, oh, an R, yeah, great. And then you, like, people ascribe an aura of invincibility to you, whether or not you deserve it. And then the moment where you get large enough that groups that were your size can start to, you know, mess with you, then that falls away naturally. And people are like, oh, you're not what you are, blah, blah, blah. But Pandemic Legion is experiencing this phenomenon at like a super level. Like, they're no longer the invincible region-ripping powerhouse in people's minds. That capability hasn't gone anywhere. Like, the Revenant that they lost had nothing to do with their ability to completely evict someone or completely turn a conflict one way or the other.
Yeah, it's immaterial. That's just what it was at that level. Like, Why do you think he was so nomad about it, bro? Because that's just what it was. Like, it was just a carrier. I mean, it was
they
a
give
fucking
no fucks.
It was a drop in the fucking bucket of what they have. Like, yeah. And, you know, why do you think What's-His-Face was so pissed off? Because it was that perceived notion that they've jumped the shark. Like, fighting, constantly fighting that aura, that cloud that just kind of, like, follows them around now.
But I think they still have it. Like, they can still, at will, just ruin anybody they want.
Sure.
The question is, if they want to get that back, where do they deploy, or who do they deploy on top of? In order to just, you know, because usually you see alliances who are going through this, deploying somewhere else, finding someone else that they can reliably dunk on and getting back their morale or whatever that way.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know Pandemic Legion members. Like, I know Elise from the CSM, and I'm friendly-ish with Shadu. We don't really talk that much, but he's a nice guy from what I know. And Celine, obviously, but I'm not, like, talking to them constantly. But my impression is that it's not really an internal morale problem. I don't think they think they're in trouble. So I don't know that they feel like they have anything to prove other than, you know, the pride of wanting to be awesome. And they are consistently doing well in the Alliance tournament, so
yeah, they can still rip down anybody they want to. You're definitely right about that.
I think that, you know, it's going to be the next big war, whatever it is. They're going to go on one side or the other. Black Legion will probably go on the opposite side, and we'll have sort of what we had in the Fountain War, except I would imagine this time that Pandemic Legion is going to be less focused on, like, protecting their bros and more focused on complete domination of the other side. So I'm going to guess that, depending on which side it is, they may go on the offensive just to give themselves more opportunities for that. Or if they do get involved, focus their efforts on attacking things instead of just constantly helping with defense. But that's extreme speculation. Who the fuck knows?
We'll see when the next war breaks out.
Mm-hmm. But definitely Black Legion and Pandemic Legion are the independent actors to watch. They're not permanently attached to any of the power blocks. So, I mean, Pandemic Legion used to be friends with CFC, and then they fought against CFC. So same could be said of Black Legion. I think they're the most interesting things going on in 00 right now. And I don't see that going to be changing anytime soon.
They're wild cards, like kind of like Mercenary Coalition used to be back in the day.
Awesome to watch. And this being the Mercenary Podcast, we will definitely keep you abreast of any developments.
Nor Academy is now recruiting. We are looking for smart players who are looking to learn small gang PvP in an immersive training environment, in a program designed for new pilots as well as grizzled 00 vets. Learn the ins and outs of merc life, including efficiency and ethics, hostile nullsec survival skills, FCing, and more. As one of EVE's oldest and most respected mercenary outfits, Nor runs a tight ship, but we always strive to have fun doing it. If you want to be part of a high-end merc PvP organization that always strives to be better tomorrow than it is today, NOR is the place for you, and NOR Academy is the place to start. Apply today through our forums at normercs.com.
Contract wrap-up. We have concluded our deployment in Ketch. And we are now taking a bit of a break while we evaluate a new corp that's trying to get into Nor Mercenary Group. We're just taking a little downtime getting to know these guys, seeing what they can bring to the table. We are available for hiring in the first week of October. So if you have anything that you want done, this would be the time before we get that backlog set up. Usually we're booked for like 2 or 3 weeks in advance once we start actively looking for contracts. Especially as we grow larger, you know, it's going to somewhat change the kind of contracts we take. We're probably going to have bigger contracts less frequently, but it's one of those things that we're Yeah. Still interested in everybody's contract offers. We're not necessarily only doing the large-scale 0-0 stuff. We will still take war decks. We will still take wormhole stuff. We will still take POS kills, POS defense, stuff in low sec. We'll go anywhere, do pretty much anything. So hit me up, and we'll let you know the results of this this corp trial on the next podcast to see if these guys made it or what the experience was.
Huzzah.
This week in Mercs, we've had some greatly increased interest in the Merc Contracts channel from new corps and alliances in terms of being listed. We've had several new corps. However, the largest and the one that I would like to highlight, just because it's interesting that they're here, I guess, is the Hashishin Cartel. And these guys are longtime facets of low second NPC 00, pretty serious PvP unit, and you can now hire them for low second, I think, 00 stuff as well. Not sure if they do Empire, don't think so. But if we are unavailable, feel free. And check out the new listings inside the Merc Contracts channel, where everyone that is not a scammer is welcome. If you think your Merc Corp is doing something interesting, send your story over to Alexei of Card in Game, and we may feature it on the podcast. That's it for episode 59, guys. Go to declarationsward.com to participate in the show poll, leave a comment, or put in a donation. We have a new donation button, something of a tip jar. You can click it just as you've always clicked it to put in any kind of donation you want, or we now have an option for a $1 recurring donation. If you are a long-time listener to the podcast, you really like it, you have a dollar a month to spare, we'd appreciate it. So definitely give it a click. Click our store link. It takes you to welovefine.com/eve, where you can check out the high-quality Declarations of War swag. Reach Noir via our public channel, CafeNoir.com, or apply to join us, Noir Academy, at the forums, www.noirmercs.com. Fly safe, everybody, and good hunting.